This is John J. York, Eric from the 80s TV show Werewolf the Series, and you're listening to the DETV Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast. Tonight on the Dead TV Podcast, before we get to our episode of Werewolf the Series,
To Dream of Wolves, Part 1 and Part 2.
The Dream of Wolves, which changes the entire focus of the show, which I've been hinting at to Mr. Zeneca leading up to our recording of it. We have on with us the one of the people that was behind the special effects of Werewolf the Series for several episodes, as well as like hundreds of other projects in Hollywood, like From Dusk Till Dawn, just for one example. We have Thomas Bellissimo on the show with us. Thank you for coming on the show with us, Thomas.
No problem. No problem at all. Everybody just calls me Tom or Tommy, not Thomas.
When we've been texting back and forth, you've been flying all over the place. What are you working on right now?
Actually, I'm not working on anything as far as film-wise. My kids took over the business. I just semi-retired. But what's happened now is I'm getting invited to all these horror fests. So I'm going to be doing my first one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and then Chicago, and then probably Florida. So, and I'm always flying all over the place. I love traveling and stuff. So I just got back from Florida, and this month I leave for Kauai.
Oh, wow.
Kauai, in Hawaii?
Yeah.
Oh, I will be on Kona. I will be on the island of Kona the last week of May.
Awesome. I just finished my last show about a year and a half ago. I did a movie with Michael Keaton that just came out called Knox Goes Away. That's actually the last production I've worked on. I've just been so
busy. Oh, wow. Yeah, he was on Jimmy Kimmel talking about that because that came out the week of the Oscars when his famous Bring It On, Bitches, like I'm Batman, you know, and that movie Knox, I think, was just in theater. But it left theater so fast, I didn't have a chance to see it. It's about like an assassin suffering from Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's.
Well, actually, it's like what Bruce Willis has.
Oh, you know? Okay.
It's quickly happening to him.
Okay,
and he's a hitman.
All right, well, hopefully it's going to be on stream. If it's not in theaters anymore, hopefully it'll be on streaming soon. Because I really wanted to see that.
It's on pay-per-view, I believe, yeah.
How did you get the job on Werewolf the Series? You were telling me that yesterday over the phone.
Well, when Werewolf came out, that was in the mid-80s. So I was young. I was just up and coming. I had worked on a bunch of shows. I did Tales from the Dark Side. That was the only other TV series that I actually was the special effects coordinator on. So here I'm getting ready to go on this new television series on a new thing called Fox TV. I got the script and went in for the interview. And during the interview, F.A. Miller, who was the production manager, asked me, he said, you know, you answered all the questions right and you have some great ideas and this and that and everything else. He says, but I'm interviewing other guys who have like 30 years experience. Why should I hire you? And I says, well, they know how to steal this much and I only know how to steal this much. And he laughed his ass off and I got the job. So that's how I got Werewolf. And I did the pilot and I did all the episodes. I was there for the whole thing.
That's amazing. Like, what contributions did you have for like the werewolf costumes, the transitions? Like, what did you do on the set?
Well, I had nothing to do with the werewolf costumes at all. Had nothing to do with the, you know, any of the makeup. I'm a mechanical effects coordinator. So all the smoke, all the rain, all the bullet hits, all the explosions, all that stuff, that's what me and my team do.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah.
You know, for instance, they came up with a thing where John York turns into this werewolf and he's in the back of a truck and we want to see camper shell bending from him trying to punch his way out. So I got together with Greg Canham at the time, was doing the makeup effects. He did most of the work. He built me this fist that was the werewolf fist made out of cement. So I'm actually inside the camper, hitting the camper from the inside. And you, from the outside, you see all these fists, you know, banging in and bending the metal. Shit like that. That's what I
do. Oh, that's great. I love it.
Yeah. So a lot of the fog, we did a lot of smoke and exterior fog to make it real gloomy and stuff inside all the forest, and a lot of rain and bullet hits and just all sorts of things. Anything that moves on the set, any prop that moves on its own, any wind, rain, fire, snow, anything like that, that's my responsibility. I'm in charge of that. That's what I did.
So like the breaking of the doors and when the yeah. house burns down. Wow,
exactly.
Great.
All that stuff, that's what me and my team did, yes.
Did you work on the hand applications? The biggest thing anyone brings up anytime they talk to John or anyone else who worked on the show is the hand application of the bleeding pentagram.
No, I did not.
Okay. That was a different part of the FX team.
Yes, that would be more of a makeup effects team.
Okay, that's fine. So we'll move on from that. What about the werewolf costume itself? We got in touch with you because we share a mutual friend who came on our show who was the stuntman werewolf wrangler for the show. And that's how he put me in touch with you.
Tony Snegoff?
Snegoff, correct. Yeah. So that's how I got your information. So I want to say thank you very much to Tony for coming on the show and putting us in touch with you. But talk about working with him with that giant werewolf costume. I mean, that thing is massive.
This is the weird thing. If you watch the show, okay, John York, his costume, his werewolf, is shorter than the bad werewolf, which was Chuck Connors or whatever and stuff, right? And that was worn by a Tony's close friend and a very good stunt guy, Alex Daniels. So Alex Daniels was the bad werewolf and Tony Snegoff was / John York as the good werewolf, you know, the one that didn't want to hurt anybody but ended up hurting people anyhow. Yeah, so I worked with Tony, did so much stuff with him. The good thing is that lots of times they were very smart. This show was very smart the way they did it. And I have to say that was from John Ashley, the producer, and F.A. Miller, who was production manager. They came up with a lot of things like Tony Snegoff was a stuntman. So what they did was they made Tony Snegoff the werewolf because he could do all the stunts in the werewolf costume. The other thing is there was just so many great people on that show when you really think about it. When I think back about it, Rick Baker, makeup effects, Greg Canham, makeup effects, even casting, Victoria Burrows, who is one of the biggest and best casting people there are and stuff. John Ashley, who was known for all the Beach Party Bingo movies and stuff like that. He was the producer of the show. But the funny thing is Frank Lupo, who was the creator of the show, and it was the thing that got me, Frank Lupo's Italian, I'm Italian. Lupo is werewolf.
Right.
It is.
So it was like, wait a minute, this guy's name is Lupo, and it's about a werewolf or about a wolf? So that got me kind of funny.
I just saw in the credits for the episodes we're about to cover, Rick Baker's name come up. How much did Rick Baker work on this show in any way, or was it his studio?
To tell you the truth, I think it was a lot of stuff from his studio. But you got to remember, back then, Rick Baker didn't have this huge studio. He was hands-on.
Okay.
So he would come on the set and stuff.
Oh.
And help. Greg Canham was awesome. And Rick Baker was just really making his bones, you know, really becoming the legend that he ended up becoming and stuff. So
I know Rick Baker left the industry because of the, you know, the use of practical special effects has just gone away and he hates the CGI and he's been really vocal about this. So, and the reason why he's retired is because he doesn't feel like films are being made the way they should be anymore. The director of, what's the movie coming out later this week? Civil War? He just said that he's retiring from filmmaking because he doesn't have the heart to make films anymore because they're not going to be made the way they should be.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring this up because, you know, a lot of us who are hands-on kind of people feel that way. And like the Marvel movies, you know, terrible, all the visual effects that they use for all the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And to the point where I have a friend of mine who does what I do. He's a special effects coordinator and whatnot. And he's in Georgia right now working on a movie. It's one of the last Marvel movies that they're going to film in Georgia before they move all the Marvel movies to Europe, to England. But this particular one, and I don't know the name of it, but the one that he's working on right now as we're speaking, well, it's Sunday, so he's off today, but is mechanical effects. They're trying to stay away from visual effects as much as possible and knock it out of the park, because Marvel is losing so much money because all they do is visual effects. You know, that's the easy thing. Oh, yeah, we'll do that in post. Yeah, we'll do that in post. And it's a joke almost. It's like, we'll do that in post. And then when you look at it, you go, man, this looks like shit.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't have looked like shit if you did it there in front of camera at the time. And then way you could have looked at it and went, oh, yeah, that works. Or no, that doesn't work. Let's do this instead. Instead, they just throw it towards the back. Yeah, we'll do it in post. And then the post guys just fucking pump the shit out. And most of the time, it looks like shit.
I know people don't like J.J. Abrams, but I give him all the credit in the world. He made a damn point about making sure that the Star Wars movies he made were made practically with practical effects. Rogue One, you can see the behind the scenes of them really getting people in the costumes for things. Star Trek Beyond, and the directors of those shows really talked about how, like, we want people in costumes and makeup and stupid-looking weird alien effects or whatever when they're walking around our Star Trek thing. We can CGI space. That's not an issue. Space needs CGI. Who cares about that? We got to CGI the Enterprise? That's fine, too. But people walking around as goofy-looking aliens in Star Trek need to be in costume and not CGI with a pogo stick. Like, you know what I mean? Werewolf. It's just everything about that show was something you could feel and touch. It looked dirty and rough, and I mean, those suits just looked awful. Looked like they got beat up a lot.
And the funny thing too is the werewolf, if you look at it, if you notice, the mouth never closes. It's always open the whole time because they didn't even have the articulating at that point. Couldn't afford it and stuff. But I love, people send me scripts, producers send me scripts and stuff like that because they know I love mechanical effects like Werewolf and whatnot and other shows. And one time, not to go off subject, but just very quickly, I got a script one time and I read it and I fell in love with it and they had no money. And that movie was called Saw. I built all the torture devices for Saw. And
wow.
We had in 18 days, I did the reverse bear trap. I did the knife, stiletto knife on his arm, all that stuff and everything, because it was a labor of love. I did it for them because I wanted to do it. We had no money.
And those mechanics are top notch. Like Saw still, to me, holds up. Because like the reverse bear trap, like I have seen people try to cosplay that and make their own. And just the amount of work that goes into it, it's intense.
Yes, thank
Excellent
you.
Excellent work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you could tell I love what I do. So sometimes you make money and sometimes you go, you know what? I'm going to do this because I want to do it.
You have to go with what you're passionate for.
Exactly.
Was there an accident on set? And thankfully, I don't ever hear about anything too bad ever happening from Werewolf. But was there ever like a big calamity on set?
I'll tell you, you always come across almost. You know what I mean? Thank God. I don't remember anybody ever getting really hurt, but we did do one episode where we had to put a house on fire and they had to escape out the front of it. You know, the stunt people and the camera people escaped out the front of it. And I was going out the back and I got stuck inside the house while it was on fire.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, no.
Was that the Halloween episode in Seneca?
It might have been the one with the witch.
Yes.
Okay.
So the one with the witch. So I ended up going, oh my God, I'm stuck in this house.
It's John Ritter's wife, right? Yeah.
I couldn't get out. So I laid on the floor to stay not catching on fire. And I had told, good thing, we always try to make sure we cross our T's and dot our I's. I told my partner at the time, Charles Ballardinelli, who was there with me and a few other guys, and I said, Charlie, I'm coming out of the back of this thing, okay? And Charlie was on the hose to put the building out of fire, you know, before it put the trees on fire and stuff. So when I didn't come out the back, Charlie said, where's Tommy? And somebody says, I think he came out the front. And Charlie just thought and went, screw it, and ran through the hole in the back of the house with the water blasting and came in. And next thing I know, I see a foot next to my face. And it's Charlie standing above me, putting the house out on fire. And then I got up and helped him. We fought the fire and escaped out the back hole. That was one of the scariest things that ever happened to me in my career.
Holy cow.
Wow.
That was on Werewolf. Yeah.
Wow. Was there other difficult shoots where you had to like figure out something like a very complicated desire that they wanted and you had to figure out some mechanical device in order to solve that situation?
Well, a lot of times, probably the riskiest thing is explosions, you know? So whether it's a door blowing apart or bullet hits going off or anything else, that's all, there is no school for what I do, okay? It's passed down, like, from one person to another. The guy who taught me, his name was Pat Patterson. He made the smoke come out of the Tin Man's hat on The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow.
Pat taught me, among other people, like my partner Charlie at the time, and we have turned other people onto it. I have kids that started with me when they're 19 years old, and now they're in charge of Fear the Walking Dead and stuff like that. So my two sons, I have four children, two sons and two daughters. My two sons have taken over the business. Now, I didn't want any of my kids to get into the business. But guess what? My two sons do special effects. My youngest daughter is an actress. And my middle daughter designs movie posters, including Saw 10.
Wow.
She just won an award for that poster. So all my kids are in the business, even though I didn't want them to be in the business. The stuff that we do, especially explosives and rigging and flying and stuff that's passed down hand to hand, there is no school for it.
You said one of your sons carried on in the family business of special effects. What are you two? You said one's an actor and one's in the special effects, right?
No, my youngest daughter is an actress. My two sons are special effects guys.
Okay, name a couple things they've worked on.
Okay, well, Knox Goes Away, which is the Michael Keaton movie.
Okay, so they worked on that one. Okay, gotcha.
The remake of Fatal Attractions TV show.
Oh, yeah, with Joshua Jackson.
Yeah, so, you know, my kids are off doing that kind of stuff. Yeah, Mrs. Davis, which was another crazy TV series and stuff with a lot of effects. So my kids are doing mechanical effects and everything. And, you know, we work hand in hand with visual effects. As a matter of fact, I'm a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures in the visual effects branch. So they made it a rule that when a movie is up for an Academy Award for special effects, there's four people's names. The fourth person is always what I do for a living, the mechanical effects coordinator. Because without us, the movie Twister would have been a twister in the background and no wind and no wood blowing all over the place. You know what I mean? So We sell the visual effect. That's what a lot of things that we do now. We work hand in hand. I did the movie The Mask with Jim Carrey.
Oh, yeah. And you also worked on Jason Goes to Hell. Are you going to be in that documentary that Adam is putting out?
Absolutely. I did a big interview already years ago with Adam when he first started. I went down to his place in El Segundo and did it. Yeah.
I'm going to be in that documentary as well. I interviewed this guy right here, Andy Mango. He actually wrote a couple articles in this old issue of Amazing Heroes from February 1992. He breaks down the original script for Batman 2, as well as he was the writer of the Freddy comic books at the time. But Adam hadn't had a chance to get into a lot of the supplement material outside of the movie. And I said to him, Guy, I'm talking to Andy about coming on Radio Horror. Do you want me to interview him for the Jason Goes to Hell documentary about the comic book that he wrote? And he said, absolutely. How are you going to do it? Are you flying out to him? I'm like, no, I don't have the ability to fly out and interview people. We're going to do it like we're doing right here on Zoom. He's like, okay, because you're doing it that way, I can't put you into the main film, but you will be a bonus feature on the Blu-ray. So just get Andy to sign this release form, and I need you to sign one as well. And they took it, and they sent it to their editor, and then they sent me the release forms and said, okay, we're all set. Sign these release forms so we can stick it on the bonus features for the interview with Andy.
I was doing a lot of New Line Cinema movies at the time, and I got called up to do Jason Goes to Hell, and then I met with Adam and stuff, and I'm like, this young kid is doing this movie.
Yeah, he was 23.
And he was like, yeah, and he was like, one of the, I have shootouts, I have this, I have that, I need you to do, and blah, blah, blah. He says, but one of the main things is in the beginning of the movie, Jason gets blown up.
Right.
And I said, okay, so we did the whole thing, and I worked with K&B Effects, me and K&B Effects at the time, Greg Nicotera and those guys.
Yep.
We worked hand in hand on a lot of shows together. What happened was, you know, he wanted to blow up Jason. So Kane Hodder is, you know, Jason and stuff. What we did was I came up with a, you know, you look up like this, you spread your hands and you look up in the sky when the guy says incoming. And then we get him out of there and we put in a foam dummy. And I did Primacord through the foam dummy to blow it up. But first a big fireball in back of him before the foam dummy blows up. And then Adam comes to me, he goes, hey, could you make the head come off and like spin in the air? I'm like, holy shit. So we came up with a way to use the explosives. We took them out of the head and we put them under the head so that when it blew apart, the head went in the air and spun in the air. But the actual part that you see where the head's spinning in the air and coming down and stuff, that was me throwing it on fire off the top of the ladder.
Oh, so, fantastic. Yeah, we covered Jason Goes to Hell on this podcast because we were doing Friday the 13th, the series, and John D. LeMay is one of the only actors to carry over from both into the TV series, into the movies, or vice versa. So when we had him on the show, we did a big coverage of Jason Goes to Hell on the podcast just because of John being on Friday the 13th, the series, for two seasons as Ryan DeLion, I think his name was. But Mr. Zeneca, do you have one more question for Thomas before we let him go?
So since there isn't any school for what you do, what advice would you give people trying to break into this business, trying to like start their career as special effects or a mechanical effects person?
Okay. Well, the first thing is we use a lot of math. Okay. Thank God now you could use computers and figure out stuff math-wise on computers and everything. So math is a very important thing. People that work with their hands, plumbers, welders, a lot of people like that, like we have to be able to do all that stuff. So if you could learn that from your, you know, somebody, or if you could take shop class up in school or whatever and stuff, working with your hands is very, very, very important. As far as explosions, if you get to work with your hands and everything else, the explosive guys like myself, I'm a one card, which is the highest license you can get. We teach everybody step by step, and there's a whole license thing that comes up inside there. But I just wrote a book, and the book is called SpecialEffectsSchool.com, and it gives lessons in practical effects. So this book, right now I'm going to be selling copies of it when I go and I do these HorrorCon things and stuff, you know, like FrankenCon and stuff like that. So nobody has ever...
Put me down for a copy, because I definitely want to read that.
Yeah,
I love the idea of the practical effect, and just like even in my own projects, I love doing like ambiance and environmental stuff, like that fog and I will thoroughly enjoy your book.
Is that book out, Thomas?
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's just going to be completed in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. But if you want to, we've been talking about it mostly in jest. But I think the fan base needs one. We've been talking about writing a unofficial Werewolf the series like episode guide book, because there isn't one out there. The Incredible Hulk has one. Friday the 13th has one. So we were like, you know, what if we wrote a book about this Werewolf the series episode by episode guide? So
anything you need, man, I'll help you out.
Okay.
And just to show you a little trick, okay? You know the glue guns that they have these days? Put the piece of glue inside of it, the tube of glue, and then the gun heats up and you squeeze the trigger and stuff. If you take air, like an air nozzle for blowing tables off and stuff, and you start squirting that glue and you put that air nozzle underneath it, it shoots that glue up in the air and the glue cools off while it's in the air, and that's how we do cobwebbing.
Excellent.
See, so I mean, there's a lot of tricks like that I'd like to show people step by step how we do it, and then named things where we did it so you could even compare it to the movie or the TV series or whatever.
Awesome. Yeah, when we if we do go ahead with this project, we'll be breaking the episodes down, writing out the plot synopsis, writing up the IMDb on the page. But if there's a special effect in there that's something amazing, I'll shoot you an email and say, hey, watch this episode and let us know, give us some behind-the-scenes info about how this was done so we can put it in the book. Even if it's just a paragraph, we don't need, you know, a huge explanation, but just like a paragraph, fill a page.
Sure.
So we're still working about the we're working on the idea because we're both still very busy right now, but it's definitely something that I think the werewolf fan base would gobble up because there's no werewolf product out there. There's not even any t-shirts unless you fan make them. Nobody knows who owns the rights to the show, by the way, because of the distribution deals changing hands and like it was on the Fox network. But apparently, I guess Sony possibly owns it or something like that. It's definitely not Disney. But who knows? Nobody's putting it on DVD. That's the problem. So, but wow. Hey, Thomas, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really do super appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to any and all canceled TV shows in the sci-fi, fantasy, and werewolf genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And there are a bevy of werewolf canceled TV shows out there. We mentioned a couple of them last time, like She-Wolf of London. And by the way, the show I was referring to called Wolfen is actually called Bitten. It stars Laura Vandervoot, as I said, who played Kara Zor-El on Smallville. And I think, and as far as I could find, there's only two seasons of it. And again, she played the only female werewolf in the world, which meant all of the packs of werewolves wanted her for their packs because, you know, alpha male need female alpha male, I guess, you know, or whatever the female equivalent of an alpha male is called.
It would still be an alpha.
Okay. We're never going to carry the cover of that show. I tried watching one episode. I was like, you know, she's really pretty to look at, but this show is not that great. But I digress. Today we are talking about a two-part revelation episodes of Werewolf the Series, in which Alamo Joe does nothing once again, Scorsese's actor is not even in it, and we're introduced to one of the greatest character actors on the history of character actors ever, from The X-Files and Fright Night Part 2 and so many other incredible things, Brian Thompson.
Yes. And the Part 1, Part 2, To Dream of Werewolves, originally aired...
Wait.
February 21st?
Hold on. No, what? It's To Dream of Wolves.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
All right, pause. What's the name of the episode, Mrs. Zeneca?
To Dream of Wolves, Part 1 and Part 2. Originally aired February 21st, 1988, and February 28th, 1988. Eric slays Scorzeny and discovers that he is not the head of the werewolf bloodline, and his death will not cure him of the curse. He meets Professor Nicholas Remy, the ancient head of his werewolf line, the one who must die to cure Eric. And Eric confronts werewolf Nicholas Remy and discovers that he is more formidable an opponent than Scorzeny ever was.
Now we also get a second female werewolf back-to-back in this episode.
We do! Diane!
Yeah, which is was shocking. I was not expecting that. When I saw that twist, I was like, because it's been a million years since I've seen these episodes. So when she's revealed to be a werewolf, when she locks John into the crater, the bunker at the very end, I was like, what?
Well, she did drop a hint because she did say that, you know, that Eric didn't have fangs yet, you know, so she must have felt that he was also a werewolf.
Right. So in this episode, young Scorzeny is played by Todd Bryant, not the actor who normally has been playing him all along. Todd is best known probably for his stunt work, but also playing a famous Klingon, Captain Clay, in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. He's got a big mat on for Kirk and will stop at nothing to stop him until the very end of the movie where he's completely humiliated by a Klingon general and forced to apologize, which for, if you know anything about Star Trek, a Klingon apologizing is probably the biggest dishonor ever. I apologize. I was acting irrational. So, but yeah, he's a long time stuntman. This young Scorzeny grew up to become like a big old stunt person, still working as up until like at least 2022. It doesn't say he's passed away, so I'm assuming he's still working.
I assume so. The actress that plays Diane, the other female werewolf that we've seen in the show, is played by Kim Johnston Ulrich.
She is.
And she is very beautiful. Very beautiful.
Yeah, she was on Supernatural for 3 episodes as Eleanor Vizek. I remember her.
She was also on Castle as Leanne Dagmar, NCIS as Nancy Hargrove, and Passions, a TV series where she played Ivory Winthrop for 739 episodes.
Wow. Holy cow.
Yeah.
But she's also played a vampire before. Have you ever seen the movie Blood Ties, Mr. Zeneca? While you were roaming the video stores as a young lady trying to find something to rent on a Saturday or Friday night, did you see a VHS box art with a woman with her neck tilted back, her breasts like in a corset kind of, with her touching her chest or whatever, and blood on her neck with the title Blood Ties?
You know, I have never seen that one.
Okay.
But it sounds like a sexy cover.
It's a sexy cover. It's definitely a sexy early 90s, late 80s, so depending on when they shot it, vampire movie. And she plays Amy Lauren in the movie, and I really do remember her from that. Not to be confused, by the way, with the Blood Ties TV show, which we could cover one day. It was a really decent show on Lifetime.
Well, she was also on an episode of Highlander as Cerdwyn.
Highlander, Mr. Zeneca's rush home from school heartthrob TV show, who she got to interview when we did the War of the Worlds series.
Yes, of course. You know, at the time in the mid-90s, he was the tits.
I remember you telling me you were like, you know, this young, impressionable teenage girl rush home from school to see this gorgeous man shirtless chopping heads off people in his very flamboyant long hair ponytail and just, you know.
And to be fair, Adrian Paul is still just as hot today as he was back then.
He doesn't look like he's aged. He is the Highlander.
He will always be the Highlander.
It's crazy. Anyway. Just like John looks like John J. York from 35 years ago.
Yeah.
There's a reason why Diana wanted to take his picture. Do you want to model for me? You say yes, John. She's going to pay you in both money and possibly sex. This is a reverse. This is a complete reverse of what you normally see at this time period. It's usually male photographers taking pictures of ladies, asking them if they'd like to come back to their place and model for them. And this is a hot, attractive female photographer who wants John to come back and model for her for money and sex. Let's face it, they were going to fuck.
Yeah,
if she wasn't a werewolf and in on the whole conspiracy theory, let's just put it in that perspective.
Well, yeah, if she was not a werewolf, she probably wouldn't have been as, you know, loose about inviting people over.
Correct. Now, where do you know Bryan Cranston from? Bryan Thompson from. Bryan Cranston's from a whole different other thing.
Yeah.
I know him from Nice Night for a Walk, huh? Do you remember that line?
From which?
Terminator.
Oh.
He's one of the punks alongside Bill Paxton that comes up to the naked Arnold Schwarzenegger right after he just came back from the future. And he's like, nice night for a walk, huh? And then I think he gets punched like right through his chest.
Well, Bryan Thompson has been on a few other shows that we've actually covered. So not only this one, he has been on Alien Nation and Kindred the Embraced.
Yes! Oh my God!
If I can get an answer back from his agent, we're hoping to have him on the phone.
I completely forgot. That's it, right. He's the Bruja leader.
Yes.
Yeah, he's the jackass Bruja leader in Kindred the Embraced.
He plays those roles so well.
Correct. Eddie Fury. It would have been great for him to come back for that. He was also he's also played a Klingon before on Star Trek. Who hasn't played a Klingon on Star Trek that looks like a big bruiser? One of the best scenes ever, besides, by the way, the alien bounty hunter in the X-Files, which I cannot believe he only played that character for 9 episodes of the X-Files. But I digress. One of the best roles ever is in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer season 2 episode. Do you remember what character he played?
Oh, no. It's been a long time since I've watched Buffy.
Okay, do you remember the episode where Buffy and Angel finally bang and Angel loses his soul? It reverts to Angelus.
It's a blurry episode for me.
This was like the big game changer of the episode. This is where we find out that eternal happiness, like true pure happiness, will break the curse and Angelus's soul will be taken away finally. And there's this creature they've been trying to resurrect called the Judge, and they reveal that no weapon forged can kill it, and Bryan Cranston plays it. And, like, Angelus walks past the Judge and goes, "You look spiffy." And he goes, "Spiffy?" And then later on in the episode, when he's, like, killing people at the mall because of the mall in the 90s would be the place to go to suck down the souls of people, because consumerism isn't already sucking out their souls. Get it? Jokes about capitalism? Anyway, he looks at Buffy and says, "No weapon forged can kill me." And then she picks up a rocket launcher and says, "That was then. This is now." And he goes, "What does that do?" And then Angelus and Drusilla just dive for it as the rocket comes screaming at the Judge and blows him to smithereens.
Wow.
So no weapon forged in his time period can kill him, which means a sword and fire wouldn't do it, but a rocket launcher.
Wow.
And they're able to get it because Xander had all of this military hardware downloaded in his brain when an episode of Halloween they all became their costumes, so he knows everything about the military, including in how to break into a military base.
great episode.
We are really trying to hope to have him on the show. It might be the ending of the show, our coverage of the show, which is coming up very soon, kind of interview, kind of like the way we've done those before, like with Yancey Butler for Witchblade and
oh, we got to get the interview first before we can promise it now. It's one step at a time.
Right, but we should plug the interview we just actually did too, though.
Yes.
Thomas Bellissimo is the special effects coordinator for this show. Now, he did not work on the hand thing. A lot of people had asked me about that in the group or whatever. Talk about the hand. I'm like, okay. But he worked on everything else. He worked with Tony Snagoff, who was the werewolf wrangler. So they worked a lot together. And then there's like dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of things he worked on as well.
So stay tuned, and you'll hear that episode in this podcast.
You'll hear part one of it in the werewolf. You'll hear... Sorry. Gotta catch my breath. I've been running it like crazy since 1 o'clock. Let me start over. You can hear what part? God damn it. Okay. You can hear part one on the Dead TV's podcast coverage of Werewolf the Series, and then you can hear part two on Radio of Horror.
Yes.
Okay. On with our two-part episode. We're going to talk about them as one episode because they do flow from one into the other. As the second episode picks up where the last one left off, but showing some footage from the previous episode. Making
Absolutely.
It a shorter episode, too, by the way.
So this episode takes place, and I couldn't determine what city this was supposed to be, but it is a busy place that they call the Quarter. And there's a mime that's kind of throughout the beginning of the first episode. This mime is just kind of joking, and I thought it might have something to do with the plot, or maybe he was a werewolf too. But no, it's just a regular mime, just a guy. And that mime is played by Alex Daniels. And in the episode, the mime unfortunately gets killed by the end of the first episode. But this mime is around and interacts quite a lot with the different background and side characters and observes Eric as he's going through a lot of the things that he's going through in this episode. So it's an odd element to add to the episode, but I think it was interesting.
Yeah, what the hell was with that mime? It never showed back up again. Like, what the hell was that?
Yeah, I don't know. So we're at this very, very busy The Quarter area, where there's musicians, there's artists. It's definitely a very tourist trap type of location. And Eric's just kind of going from person to person, trying to find Squarzenny. You know, has anyone seen this man? Has anyone seen Squarzenny?
Yeah, like he always does.
Yeah, you know, of course. And then he meets Diane, the photographer, who, as we've said before, wants to take pictures of him.
And have sex with him.
Maybe.
Oh, come on! I've seen how this porno plays out. She's a good-looking guy, girl. He's a good-looking guy. They'll transform into their werewolf forms, and it will be like the scene in Howling 2 where your sister is a werewolf. Do you know that scene?
I think so.
Okay, there's a werewolf orgy in the middle of the movie.
The
suits were supposed to be used for some monkey film, or maybe it was like Planet of the Apes or something. And they didn't get the werewolf costumes they needed, so they had all the actors wearing these, like, monkey suits, and they just altered the makeup on the faces to look like wolves.
Yeah. Alamo Joe is there.
Oh, yeah, great.
And he's smoking and... Yeah, he's smoking and waiting for Eric, but Eric sees him first and then dashes off to meet up with the photographer because he knew that was a place that he would... be able to go and hide out from Alamo Joe.
I do not get why everyone loves this character. I mean, he's got a cool look to him, and he's got that cool voice like Sam Elliott, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, from the Big Lebowski or anything Sam Elliott has done. So I get the look, but this character is just badly written, people. They do nothing with him. It show up. Does nothing, shows up again, everything's already done, the end. And I know people have said, oh, well, if he catches Eric, it's the end of the show, Chris, and, oh, it's just, you know, they need to drag out that plot line. By the way, according to IMDb, I think this is the last time we see him, correct? Because we only got 3 episodes left.
I have not looked ahead, so I cannot tell you that.
Yeah, Blind Luck, Grey Wolf, and Amazing Grace, I think, I do not think Alamo Joe is in these episodes, but we'll find out soon.
So in this episode, we get a lot of the back... conversation, like there's a voiceover from previous episodes about Eric's transformations, about his curse. You know, there's a lot of Alamo Joe talking and then Scorzeny's voice, but we don't actually see the actor that plays Scorzeny in this episode.
Joe is in 2 episodes, so of the 3.
Every scene that we see Scorzeny, or at least he's supposed to be in that scene, he's obscured. The face is turned away from the camera at the back, the kind of over the shoulder type of shot. So you know that actor is not in the scene whatsoever. And when we actually find Scorzeny and he is in his werewolf form, a big brawl happens between him and Eric and with Diane kind of in the middle. And she plays this very innocent, oh no, this is, what's going on? And then you find out, you know, at the end of that first episode that, boom, she's a werewolf. It comes out of nowhere.
That shocked me. I was like, whoa! I was actually generally, I didn't jump, but I was really generally surprised, and I thought that was really cool that they definitely kept that hidden. Here's a quick question. Eddie Cord. Who is that?
Mm-hmm. What?
Eddie Cord in the credits. Who is Eddie Cord?
Eddie Cord,
played by Chuck Long. okay, is he Eric's brother or something? I don't remember Eddie Cord.
I don't remember that character either.
He's in the credits for both parts. And you think Cord? Like Eric Cord? Eric's brother? I'm assuming it would be like Eric's brother, because the actor doesn't look that much older than John.
Yeah, I don't know.
You're seeing the same thing I am on IMDb, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So anyone in the comments section of the episode or on IMDb, or you want to send me an email, thatradiohorror@gmail.com, explain to me who Eddie Cord is, because this episode was pretty tight in its cast. We've got, you know, it's mostly Eric, Diana, and Nicholas Remy. That's it. Everyone else is kind of the mime.
Side characters. There is the blind woman who has one line, and this is her only acting cred in IMDb.
Right. But
Mel Reed. And then there's, I guess, I don't know what if he's a bookseller or a transient or, you know, some sort of, you know, person at the quarter named Bob Phillips. And who Eric takes the acid from his station.
Huh.
Hydrochloric acid.
Yeah. Do we know who plays Scorzeny in this episode, besides young Scorzeny?
No. There's no credit for another Scorzeny.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'll post that in the werewolf group and find out if someone knows the answer, because, yeah, that's a mystery. Do you think it was possibly possibly our former guest, Tony, as the werewolf?
I don't know. Yeah.
Interesting.
So we meet Nicholas Remy, and he is very modern looking for the time period, of course. Like, he's wearing a suit, but without the suit jacket, playing pool when we first meet him. He looks very put together. He looks very kind of elegant as a, you know, mid to late 80s yuppie would have been. And he is ancient. We don't know exactly how old he is, but within these two episodes, we do see Eric touching objects and then having a flashback that would have been the flashback from Nicholas Remy's life. And we see that Nicholas Remy was an SS German officer. He was some sort of judge in a medieval period of time period that convicted someone for eating a dead body, but not for lycanthropy. So his infection goes back centuries, but you don't see the aging that we saw with Skorzeny. And he explains that as that Skorzeny was tainted and he was corrupt. Mm. And so his body was failing him because he was so corrupt and took his gift, as he calls it, he took his gift and he squandered it, you know, causing chaos everywhere. But yet, Nicholas Remy supported Skorzeny's activities because they served some sort of interior purpose for him. Even though he kind of banned him from the city that they're in, you know, 60 years ago. And he was very pissed that Skorzeny had shown up and leaving a trail of blood behind him.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, John hopes that, like, Diana will side with him because of the way, just the, you know, jerk-off way that Remy is, and she doesn't do much, except for in the very end, she does help him just before she finally succumbs to her throat/wounds. You think, like, with the Incredible Hulk, when Banner gets shot or injured, he turns into the Hulk and injuries are healed. You think it'd be the same way with, like, this? You know what I mean?
Well, maybe it's different because this was a slash mark from Remy's paw.
And he's the original, so yeah. And he did you also notice in a flashback he was a Nazi?
Yes, yes. And that's actually one of the points because he met Diane, presumably, while she's singing opera as what I assume, based on the costume and you know, character, that she might have been a Jewish concentration camp person.
Oh.
And so she's singing opera, and Nicholas Remy comes into the dressing room and then puts a paw on her shoulder, and then I guess that's it. And, you know, that from that point on, she was going to be a werewolf.
In the TV series Grimm, Nick, the detective, the Grimm, who hunts, who can see the creatures for who they really are, you know, past their glamour of them shimmering into their human form. Mm-hmm. And he's watching an old film reel of Nazi Germany and Hitler giving a speech, and he pauses it when he sees Hitler shimmering, and Hitler turns into like a wolf. Revealing that Hitler was a Blutblund, which is the werewolves kind of characters on the show. Silas Ware Mitchell was the Blutblund who helped Nick out in every episode. And you can go on the Radio Horror YouTube channel and check out an interview I did with him.
There was some historical basis that groups of German officers had collectively called themselves wolves, werewolves, in order to be like a fear tactic, to kind of show that they were more brutal and ruthless. And so they adopted that wolf mantle just to kind of show off their brutality.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see the movie Overlord?
I don't think so.
Oh, find it and check it out. Kind of a sleeper hit. Came out in 2019, October of 2019. It's about a bunch of soldiers diving, parachuting into France just the day before D-Day to knock out a radio tower to help the Allies. And they come to a town in France which is completely deserted, with the exception of one girl and her son, her brother. And they find out that the Nazis have been taking people from the town and bringing them up to this castle. And in the castle, they've been doing these terrible experiments on them and turning them into monsters.
Oh, wow.
It's fantastic. You want a no-holds-barred, blood-and-guts horror action movie? Watch Overlord. It's incredible. It's kind of like, what was the video game called? First-person shooter.
Wolfenstein.
Yeah. Okay. Wolfenstein, which also had werewolf Nazis at some point, too.
Yep.
So, yeah. Trust me, Mr. Zeneca. You will have a blast watching this movie.
So do you think that this is a new power that they're showing about Eric touching these objects and then seeing these flashbacks?
Yes. It's called the running out of time for the show power.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but that's exactly what it is. All of a sudden, he's got new abilities. You know what I mean? We haven't exactly interviewed anybody other than John J. York, and I'm not going to bother him right now about like what was going to happen after the next for the season two. So,
yeah. So at the end of the episode, we presume that Diane is dead. You know, they say that they found a body, but as we've seen before, werewolves can come back to life. You know, so. They say that there's a body, so we presume that Diane is dead. Nicholas Remy is missing, and they don't know what happened. The officer is trying to talk with Alamo Joe about, you know, what he thinks about the situation, and Alamo Joe admits that he was wrong.
Right.
And that was something. Like, he admits that he was wrong, and that Scorzini had something to do with it. And, he just thought that Scorzini was just a navalman, just a sailor.
Yeah, and the cop is just like, you know, above our pay grade, dude, let stuff go.
Yes.
Like, you know, like, seriously, you need to stop this obsession with this kid because you've been wrong.
Yeah, you know, and the officer says that, you know, usually when a killer goes out to kill, they have a specific MO, and that is absolutely true. You know, a person that loves to stab people will always love to stab people. They don't change it up into being an arsonist. You know, so he finds this entire situation to be extremely suspect and even kind of questioning whether Eric is really doing these murders because he's switching up the mode of death. And that's just something that doesn't happen so often. Especially with serial killers.
Overall, I thought these two episodes were phenomenal. They really changed the direction of the show. Unfortunately, it changes too late because we only got three episodes left. But
yeah, I love these two episodes. I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was a dynamic way to show the story of the character through the flashbacks. It's quite kind of an interesting new ability to have, but for storytelling methods, I enjoyed it, and I also have, like, more questions than answers on where did he get his werewolf infection, you know, something like this, you know, if you were to go off the,
wow,
off the vampire mantra, the vampire mythos, it was something like God or the devil or some sort of, you know, celestial force changed the person.
I can answer your question. I don't know. But what?
So I want to know where he got his werewolfism.
Okay, so did you ever watch The Vampire Diaries?
No.
In The Vampire Diaries, they came up with a really incredible explanation about both where the werewolf and the vampire lineage come from. A son of the moon and a son of the son of the bat and the son of the wolf, or something like that. I'm sure you can find a clip of it on YouTube. Go.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast. Tonight on the Dead TV Podcast, before we get to our episode of Werewolf the Series,
to Dream of Wolves, Part 1 and Part 2.
The Dream of Wolves, which changes the entire focus of the show, which I've been hinting at to Mr. Zeneca leading up to our recording of it. We have on with us the one of the people that was behind the special effects of Werewolf the Series for several episodes, as well as like hundreds of other projects in Hollywood, like From Dusk Till Dawn, just for one example. We have Thomas Bellissimo on the show with us. Thank you for coming on the show with us, Thomas.
No problem. No problem at all. Everybody just calls me Tom or Tommy, not Thomas.
When we've been texting back and forth, you've been flying all over the place. What are you working on right now?
Actually, I'm not working on anything as far as film-wise. My kids took over the business. I just semi-retired. But what's happened now is I'm getting invited to all these horror fests. So I'm going to be doing my first one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and then Chicago, and then probably Florida. So, and I'm always flying all over the place. I love traveling and stuff. So I just got back from Florida, and this month I leave for Kauai.
Kauai in Hawaii?
Yeah.
Oh, the I will be on Kona. I will be on the island of Kona the last week of May.
Awesome. I just finished my last show about a year and a half ago. I did a movie with Michael Keaton that just came out called Knox Goes Away. That's actually the last production I've worked on. I've just been so
busy. Oh, wow. Yeah, he was on Jimmy Kimmel talking about that because that came out the week of the Oscars when his famous Bring It On, Bitches, like I'm Batman, you know, and that movie Knox, I think, was just in theater. But it left theater so fast, I didn't have a chance to see it. It's about like an assassin suffering from Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's. Well,
actually, it's like what Bruce Willis has.
Oh, you know? Okay.
It's quickly happening to him.
Okay,
and he's a hitman.
All right, well, hopefully it's going to be on stream. If it's not in theaters anymore, hopefully it'll be on streaming soon. Because I really wanted to see that.
It's on pay-per-view, I believe, yeah.
How did you get the job on Werewolf the Series? You were telling me that yesterday over the phone.
Well, when Werewolf came out, that was in the mid-80s. So I was young. I was just up and coming. I had worked on a bunch of shows. I did Tales from the Dark Side. That was the only other TV series that I actually was the special effects coordinator on. So here I'm getting ready to go on this new television series on a new thing called Fox TV. I got the script and went in for the interview. And during the interview, F.A. Miller, who was the production manager, asked me, he said, you know, you answered all the questions right and you have some great ideas and this and that and everything else. He says, but I'm interviewing other guys who have like 30 years experience. Why should I hire you? And I says, well, they know how to steal this much and I only know how to steal this much. And he laughed his ass off and I got the job. So that's how I got Werewolf. And I did the pilot and I did all the episodes. I was there for the whole thing.
That's amazing. Like, what contributions did you have for like the werewolf costumes, the transitions? Like, what did you do on the set?
Well, I had nothing to do with the werewolf costumes at all. Had nothing to do with the, you know, any of the makeup. I'm a mechanical effects coordinator. So all the smoke, all the rain, all the bullet hits, all the explosions, all that stuff, that's what me and my team do.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah.
You know, for instance, they came up with a thing where John York turns into this werewolf and he's in the back of a truck and we want to see camper shell bending from him trying to punch his way out. So I got together with Greg Canham at the time, was doing the makeup effects. He did most of the work. He built me this fist that was the werewolf fist made out of cement. So I'm actually inside the camper, hitting the camper from the inside. And you, from the outside, you see all these fists, you know, banging in and bending the metal. Shit like that. That's what I
did. Oh, that's great. I love it.
Yeah. So a lot of the fog, we did a lot of smoke and exterior fog to make it real gloomy and stuff inside all the forest, and a lot of rain and bullet hits and just all sorts of things. Anything that moves on the set, any prop that moves on its own, any wind, rain, fire, snow, anything like that, that's my responsibility. I'm in charge of that. That's what I did.
So like the breaking of the doors and when the house burns down. Wow,
exactly.
Great.
All that stuff, that's what me and my team did, yes.
Did you work on the hand applications? The biggest thing anyone brings up anytime they talk to John or anyone else who worked on the show is the hand application of the bleeding pentagram.
No, I did not.
Okay. That was a different part of the FX team.
Yes, that would be more of a makeup effects team.
Okay, that's fine. So we'll move on from that. What about the werewolf costume itself? We got in touch with you because we share a mutual friend who came on our show who was the stuntman werewolf wrangler for the show. And that's how he put me in touch with you.
Tony Snegoff?
Snegoff, correct. Yeah. So that's how I got your information. So I want to say thank you very much to Tony for coming on the show and putting us in touch with you. But talk about working with him with that giant werewolf costume. I mean, that thing is massive.
This is the weird thing. If you watch the show, okay, John York, his costume, his werewolf, is shorter than the bad werewolf, which was Chuck Connors or whatever and stuff, right? And that was worn by a Tony's close friend and a very good stunt guy, Alex Daniels. So Alex Daniels was the bad werewolf and Tony Snegoff was / John York as the good werewolf, you know, the one that didn't want to hurt anybody but ended up hurting people anyhow. Yeah, so I worked with Tony, did so much stuff with him. The good thing is that lots of times they were very smart. This show was very smart the way they did it. And I have to say that was from John Ashley, the producer, and F.A. Miller, who was production manager. They came up with a lot of things like Tony Snegoff was a stuntman. So what they did was they made Tony Snegoff the werewolf because he could do all the stunts in the werewolf costume. The other thing is there was just so many great people on that show when you really think about it. When I think back about it, Rick Baker, makeup effects, Greg Canham, makeup effects, even casting, Victoria Burroughs, who is one of the biggest and best casting people there are and stuff. John Ashley, who was known for all the Beach Party Bingo movies and stuff like that. He was the producer of the show. But the funny thing is Frank Lupo, who was the creator of the show, and it was the thing that got me, Frank Lupo's Italian, I'm Italian. Lupo is werewolf.
Right.
It is.
So it was like, wait a minute, this guy's name is Lupo, and it's about a werewolf or about a wolf? So that got me kind of funny.
I just saw in the credits for the episodes we're about to cover, Rick Baker's name come up. How much did Rick Baker work on this show in any way, or was it his studio?
To tell you the truth, I think it was a lot of stuff from his studio. But you got to remember, back then, Rick Baker didn't have this huge studio. He was hands-on.
Okay.
So he would come on the set and stuff.
Oh.
And help. Greg Canham was awesome. And Rick Baker was just really making his bones, you know, really becoming the legend that he ended up becoming and stuff. So
I know Rick Baker left the industry because of the, you know, the use of practical special effects has just gone away and he hates the CGI and he's been really vocal about this. So, and the reason why he's retired is because he doesn't feel like films are being made the way they should be anymore. The director of, what's the movie coming out later this week? Civil War? He just said that he's retiring from filmmaking because he doesn't have the heart to make films anymore because they're not going to be made the way they should be.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring this up because, you know, a lot of us who are hands-on kind of people feel that way. And like the Marvel movies, you know, terrible, all the visual effects that they use for all the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And to the point where I have a friend of mine who does what I do. He's a special effects coordinator and whatnot. And he's in Georgia right now working on a movie. It's one of the last Marvel movies that they're going to film in Georgia before they move all the Marvel movies to Europe, to England. But this particular one, and I don't know the name of it, but the one that he's working on right now as we're speaking, well, it's Sunday, so he's off today, but is mechanical effects. They're trying to stay away from visual effects as much as possible and knock it out of the park because Marvel is losing so much money because all they do is visual effects. You know, that's the easy thing. Oh, yeah, we'll do that in post. Yeah, we'll do that in post. And it's a joke almost. It's like, we'll do that in post. And then when you look at it, you go, man, this looks like shit.
Yeah.
Well, It wouldn't have looked like shit if you did it there in front of camera at the time, and then way you could have looked at it and went, oh yeah, that works, or no, that doesn't work, let's do this instead. Instead, they just throw it towards the back. Yeah, we'll do it in post, and then the post guys just fucking pump the shit out, and most of the time it looks like shit.
I know people don't like J.J. Abrams, but I give him all the credit in the world. He made a damn point about making sure that the Star Wars movies he made were made practically, with practical effects. Rogue One, you can see the behind the scenes of them really getting people in the costumes for things. Star Trek Beyond, and the directors of those shows really talked about how, like, we want people in costumes and makeup and stupid-looking weird alien effects or whatever when they're walking around our Star Trek thing. CGI space. That's not an issue. Space needs CGI. Who cares about that? We got to CGI the Enterprise? That's fine, too. But people walking around as goofy-looking aliens in Star Trek need to be in costume. And not CGI with a pogo stick, like, you know what I mean? Werewolf. It's just everything about that show was something you could feel and touch. It looked dirty and rough, and I mean, those suits just looked awful. Looked like they got beat up a lot.
And the funny thing too is the werewolf. If you look at it, if you notice, the mouth never closes. It's always open the whole time because they didn't even have the articulating at that point. Couldn't afford it and stuff. But I love. People send me scripts, producers send me scripts and stuff like that because they know I love mechanical effects like Werewolf and whatnot and other shows. And one time, not to go off subject, but just very quickly, I got a script one time and I read it and I fell in love with it and they had no money and that movie was called Saw. I built all the torture devices for Saw. And we shot that in 18 days. I did the reverse bear trap. I did the knife, stiletto knife on his arm, all that stuff and everything, because it was a labor of love. I did it for them because I wanted to do it. We had no money.
And those mechanics are top notch. Like Saw still, to me, holds up. Because like the reverse bear trap, like I have seen people try to cosplay that and make their own. And just the amount of work that goes into it, it's intense.
Yes, thank you.
Excellent work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you could tell I love what I do. So sometimes you make money and sometimes you go, you know what? I'm going to do this because I want to do it.
You have to go with what you're passionate for.
Exactly.
Was there an accident on set? And thankfully, I don't ever hear about anything too bad ever happening from Werewolf. But was there ever like a big calamity on set?
I'll tell you, you always come across almost. You know what I mean? Thank God. I don't remember anybody ever getting really hurt, but we did do one episode where we had to put a house on fire and they had to escape out the front of it. You know, the stunt people and the camera people escaped out the front of it. And I was going out the back and I got stuck inside the house while it was on fire.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, no.
Was that the Halloween episode in Seneca?
It might have been the one with the witch.
Yes.
Okay.
So the one with the witch. So I ended up going, oh my God, I'm stuck in this house.
John Ritter's wife, right? Yeah.
I couldn't get out. So I laid on the floor to stay not catching on fire. And I had told, good thing, we always try to make sure we cross our T's and dot our I's. I told my partner at the time, Charles Ballardinelli, who was there with me and a few other guys, and I said, Charlie, I'm coming out of the back of this thing, okay? And Charlie was on the hose to put the building out of fire, you know, before it put the trees on fire and stuff. So when I didn't come out the back, Charlie said, where's Tommy? And somebody says, I think he came out the front. And Charlie just thought and went, screw it, and ran through the hole in the back of the house with the water blasting. And came in, and next thing I know, I see a foot next to my face, and it's Charlie standing above me, putting the house out on fire, and then I got up and helped him. We fought the fire and escaped out the back hole. That was one of the scariest things that ever happened to me in my career.
Holy cow.
Wow.
That was on Werewolf. Yeah.
Wow. Was there other difficult shoots where you had to like figure out something like a very complicated desire that they wanted and you had to figure out some mechanical device in order to solve that situation?
Well, a lot of times, probably the riskiest thing is explosions, you know? So whether it's a door blowing apart or bullet hits going off or anything else, that's all, there is no school for what I do, okay? It's passed down, like, from one person to another. The guy who taught me, his name was Pat Patterson. He made the smoke come out of the Tin Man's hat on The Wizard of Oz.
Oh,
so, oh wow.
Pat taught me, among other people, like my partner Charlie at the time, and we have turned other people onto it. I have kids that started with me when they're 19 years old, and now they're in charge of Fear the Walking Dead and stuff like that. So my two sons, I have four children, two sons and two daughters. My two sons have taken over the business. Now, I didn't want any of my kids to get into the business, but guess what? My two sons do special effects. My youngest daughter is an actress, and my middle daughter designs movie posters, including Saw 10.
Wow.
She just won an award for that poster. So all my kids are in the business, even though I didn't want them to be in the business. The stuff that we do, especially explosives and rigging and flying and stuff that's passed down hand to hand, there is no school for it.
You said one of your sons carried on in the family business of special effects. What are you two? You said one's an actor and one's in the special effects, right?
No, my youngest daughter is an actress. My two sons are special effects guys.
Okay, name a couple things they've worked on.
Okay, well, Knox Goes Away, which is the Michael Keaton movie.
Okay, so they worked on that one. Okay, gotcha.
The remake of Fatal Attractions TV show.
Oh, yeah, with Joshua Jackson.
Yeah, so, you know, my kids are off doing that kind of stuff. Yeah, Mrs. Davis, which was another crazy TV series and stuff with a lot of effects. So my kids are doing mechanical effects and everything. And, you know, we work hand in hand with visual effects. As a matter of fact, I'm a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures in the visual effects branch. So they made it a rule that when a movie is up for an Academy Award for special effects, there's four people's names. The fourth person is always what I do for a living, the mechanical effects coordinator. Because without us, the movie Twister would have been a twister in the background and no wind and no wood blowing all over the place. You know what I mean? So We sell the visual effect. That's what a lot of things that we do now. We work hand in hand. I did the movie The Mask with Jim Carrey.
Oh, yeah. And you also know, worked on Jason Goes to Hell. Are you going to be in that documentary that Adam is putting out?
Absolutely. I did a big interview already years ago with Adam when he first started. I went down to his place in El Segundo and did it. Yeah.
I'm going to be in that documentary as well. I interviewed this guy right here, Andy Mangels. He actually wrote a couple articles in this old issue of Amazing Heroes from February 1992. He breaks down the original script for Batman 2, as well as he was the writer of the Freddy comic books at the time. But Adam hadn't had a chance to get into a lot of the supplement material outside of the movie. And I said to him, Guy, I'm talking to Andy about coming on Radio Horror. Do you want me to interview him for the Jason Goes to Hell documentary about the comic book that he wrote? And he said, absolutely. How are you going to do it? Are you flying out to him? I'm like, no, I don't have the ability to fly out and interview people. We're going to do it like we're doing right here on Zoom. He's like, okay, because you're doing it that way, I can't put you into the main film, but you will be a bonus feature on the Blu-ray. So just get Andy to sign this release form, and I need you to sign one as well. And they took it, and they sent it to their editor, and then they sent me the release forms and said, okay, we're all set. Sign these release forms so we can stick it on the bonus features for an interview with Andy.
I was doing a lot of New Line Cinema movies at the time, and I got called up to do Jason Goes to Hell, and then I met with Adam and stuff, and I'm like, this young kid is doing this movie.
Yeah, he was 23.
And he was like, one of the I have shootouts, I have this, I have that, I need you to do, and blah, blah, blah. He says, but one of the main things is in the beginning of the movie, Jason gets blown up.
Right.
And I said, okay, so we did the whole thing, and I worked with K&B Effects. Me and K&B Effects at the time, Greg Nicotera and those guys.
Yep.
We worked hand in hand on a lot of shows together. What happened was, you know, he wanted to blow up Jason. So Kane Hodder is, you know, Jason and stuff. What we did was I came up with a, you know, you look up like this, you spread your hands and you look up in the sky when the guy says incoming. And then we get him out of there and we put in a foam dummy. And I did Primacord through the foam dummy to blow it up. But first a big fireball in back of him before the foam dummy blows up. And then Adam comes to me, he goes, hey, could you make the head come off and like spin in the air? I'm like, holy shit. So we came up with a way to use the explosives. We took them out of the head and we put them under the head so that when it blew apart, the head went in the air and spun in the air. But the actual part that you see where the head's spinning in the air and coming down and stuff, that was me throwing it on fire off the top of the ladder.
Oh, so, fantastic. Yeah, we covered Jason Goes to Hell on this podcast because we were doing Friday the 13th, the series. And John D. LeMay is one of the only actors to carry over from both into the TV series, into the movies, or vice versa. So when we had him on the show, we did a big coverage of Jason Goes to Hell on the podcast just because of John being on Friday the 13th, the series, for two seasons as Ryan DeLion, I think his name was. But Mr. Zeneca, do you have one more question for Thomas before we let him go?
So since there isn't any school for what you do, what advice would you give people trying to break into this business, trying to like start their career as special effects or a mechanical effects person?
Okay. Well, the first thing is we use a lot of math. Okay. Thank God now you could use computers and figure out stuff math-wise on computers and everything. So math is a very important thing. People that work with their hands, plumbers, welders, a lot of people like that, like we have to be able to do all that stuff. So if you could learn that from your, you know, somebody, or if you could take shop class up in school or whatever and stuff, working with your hands is very, very, very important. As far as explosions, if you get to work with your hands and everything else, the explosive guys like myself, I'm a one card, which is the highest license you can get. We teach everybody step by step, and there's a whole license thing that comes up inside there. But I just wrote a book, and the book is called SpecialEffectsSchool.com, and it gives lessons in practical effects. So this book, right now I'm going to be selling copies of it when I go and I do these HorrorCon things and stuff, you know, like FrankenCon and stuff like that. So nobody has ever
put me down for a copy, because I definitely want to read that.
I love
the idea of the practical effect, and just like even in my own projects, I love doing like ambiance and environmental stuff, like that fog and I will thoroughly enjoy your book.
Is that book out, Thomas?
No, it isn't. It isn't. It's just going to be completed in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. We've been talking about it mostly in jest. But I think the fan base needs one. We've been talking about writing a unofficial Werewolf the series like episode guide book, because there isn't one out there. The Incredible Hulk has one. Friday the 13th has one. So we were like, you know, what if we wrote a book about this Werewolf the series episode by episode guide? So
I'll help.
That conversation.
Anything you need, man, I'll help you out.
Okay.
And just to show you a little trick, okay? You know the glue guns that they have these days? Put the piece of glue inside of it, the tube of glue, and then the gun heats up and you squeeze the trigger and stuff. If you take air, like an air nozzle for blowing tables off and stuff, and you start squirting that glue and you put that air nozzle underneath it, it shoots that glue up in the air and the glue cools off while it's in the air, and that's how we do cobwebbing.
Excellent.
See, so I mean, there's a lot of tricks like that I'd like to show people step by step how we do it, and then name things where we did it so you could even compare it to the movie or the TV series or whatever.
Awesome. Yeah, if we do go ahead with this project, we'll be breaking the episodes down, writing out the plot synopsis, writing up the IMDb on the page. But if there's a special effect in there that's something amazing, I'll shoot you an email and say, hey, watch this episode and let us know, give us some behind-the-scenes info about how this was done so we can put it in the book. Even if it's just a paragraph, we don't need, you know, a huge explanation, but just like a paragraph to fill a page.
Sure.
So we're still working about we're working on the idea because we're both still very busy right now, but it's definitely something that I think the Werewolf fan base would gobble up, because there's no Werewolf product out there. There's not even any t-shirts unless you fan make them. Nobody knows who owns the rights to the show, by the way, because of the distribution deals changing hands, and like it was on the Fox network. But apparently, I guess Sony possibly owns it or something like that. It's definitely not Disney, but who knows? Nobody's putting it on DVD. That's the problem. So, but wow. Hey, Thomas, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really do super appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Look it up, because I thought it was a very smart way of coming up with, like, where does the original werewolf come from? Where does the original vampire come from in this universe? You know, in let's say Marvel Comics, if you have Disney Plus, they put out a Halloween special last year called Werewolf by Night. Did you have a chance to watch it?
I have not, no.
Okay, it's 45 minutes. It's about a group of monster hunters that have to hunt down a creature and get the Bloodstone, because UCS Bloodstone, the famous monster hunter, has died, and he has gathered his widow, the stepmother of Eliza Bloodstone, has gathered together the greatest monster hunters ever to hunt down the Man-Thing, a very well-known, prominent Marvel comic book monster, to get the Bloodstone from him. And one of these monster hunters is, in fact, Jack Russell, the Werewolf by Night. And they don't explain his origin, but in the Werewolf by Night comic books, it's explained that on the 18th birthday of the Russell family curse, you will just become a werewolf, because that's your lot in life, because you're part of the bloodline.
Historically, like, having it be a curse is a thing. You know, I'll go into it when I do the, you know, more werewolf deep dives. But yeah, that cursed element. So, like, who cursed Nicholas Remy? Who cursed him?
Or maybe it's something. I don't. We'll find out if we get into it on this show. So, don't forget, you can find us on the Werewolf TV show group. Don't forget that if you decide to skip over the interview before this episode, please go back and listen to it. You can send us an email, thatradiohorror@gmail.com. You can also send us, look us up on Twitter at ChristySAB and Elegantly Kinky. And we'll be back next week with another couple of exciting episodes of Werewolf the Series. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with another couple exciting episodes of the final episodes of Werewolf the Series here on the Dead TV Podcast.
Good night.